Well, if you take the LC circuit that you use as a filter, so in the generator or in the receiver, but then you're dealing with, say, series resonance circuit, right? And the higher the inductance, the lower the capacitor, the lower the filter bandwidth is. So really the reactance of the inductance L, or the, say the capacitor C, we can name it, at the resonance frequency will be relatively high compared to the, say source load resistances. My problem is that you're not mentioning how strong is the signal of the generator, because the stronger it is, the bandwidth of the receiving filter is reacting differently to it. So I believe if we don't have a standardized factor, we wouldn't be able to measure the sensitivity at all. We'd be ending nowhere. And so it's here.
We were talking about selectivity.
I said selectivity. Isn't the selectivity the performance of the radio receiver to respond only to the radio signal that is tuned to the particular frequency rejecting others? Or maybe I'm missing something. I think that's a perfect explanation of sensitivity.
Until John made his statement right now, well, you used the word sensitivity multiple times. The original question was selectivity. If there is the IF selectivity to be measured.
But this two selectivity is
measurement. To take a standard measurement by finding out how much signal strength of the signal generator is required to get an S9 response, and then slowly move the frequency up and down in known increments and plot the results, and once again measuring how much signal generator requirement to get back to the standard measurement of S9 in my example. And you could, if you want, yes, you are bringing up a interesting point. Let me drop. And that is, when you make the measurement at S9 and you measure the selectivity of the IF strip, you'll get one particular curve. Because of the automatic gain control function of the average receiver, if you did the exact same measurements at S2 instead of S9, you'll get a very slightly different curve. Not significantly different. That is selectivity of the IF strip. Now the much more elaborate set of measurements can be made, where at a strong signal generator output, you can now start looking for the image response, the second harmonic of the local oscillator response, all of the spurious responses of the receiver, and every receiver has got them. That's a much, much more elaborate test, spurious signal responses, which is not the original question. The original question was selectivity, and the selectivity of the IF strip is something, let me drop.
I was just misspelling, but I was talking about selectivity. Everything that I said matches selectivity. And to exchange.
The selectivity of the IF strip on the average receiver is what knob you flipped on the front panel. You rotated the dial so you selected the 3 kilohertz filter according to the receiver manufacturer. He's giving you a 3 kilohertz filter. He's giving you a 1 kilohertz filter and maybe a CW filter at 200 hertz or 250 hertz. So you select that particular filter and then repeat this particular test. You, as the testing of the receiver as a black box, to measure its selectivity, you didn't have to know what is the capacitor to inductor ratio of that filter. That's something that's built into the receiver. You didn't have to know that. You consider the receiver as a black box. When you measure its sensitivity, you plot that curve as to what power output is required from the signal generator on each one of those frequencies you go to. And when you look at that plot, it's going to look like a bathtub curve, and you take that curve and you flip it upside down, and it's going to give you the IF bandpass of that filter, the selectivity of the IF bandpass, with its shape factor, with its flatness across the top, and all the other performance of that IF strip. But the spurious responses of the front end, that's an entirely different set of tests that are a hell of a lot more elaborate, and there's a lot of ways you can go wrong, and we haven't gone there yet. Yes, know that those glitches of a receiver do exist, but my understanding, I'm going to pass it back to John now for a repeat on that. I think the question was only about selectivity plotting, how would you do it, and we've now given him one possible approach as to how to measure the selectivity. If your receiver, let me drop. If your receiver happens to have a very good frequency synthesizer for the local oscillator of the receiver, you could do the whole thing in reverse. Start off with a very known, very steady frequency, very steady power output signal generator. Leave the signal generator on one frequency and slowly sweep the receiver up and down and make that plot and readjust the power output of the signal generator. So whether you sweep the signal generator or whether you sweep the receiver or whether you do both and see if the curves come out the same is your choice. So I think the original question was only selectivity, and although the person didn't say IF strip, by far in the average receiver, that's a super heterodyne design, 98% of the selectivity takes place in the IF strip. Therefore, selectivity of the IF strip is the test procedure that we have indicated so far. Am I wrong on the original question, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, you're absolutely right. This gentleman, if you remember, was questioning sensitivity, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and you gave a thorough explanation on that, and now he wants to know about selectivity, and your exact explanation, you're right on target. Back to you, Dick.
Now, there was another person who signed in outside the area. Slowly give me your call letters and your name first. Let's get that first before we proceed. Who was that other person who had a question on this particular subject, KQRIW and the Technical Net on Long Island?
004, Uniform, Hilo Charlie.
Okay, I heard Kilo, Kilo 4, Uniform, Kilo Charlie. Please start off with your name, sir, and then your question on this particular subject. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
My name is Gene. Golf Echo November Echo. Golf Echo November Echo.
Okay, we got your name, Gene. What is your question on this particular subject, Gene? Go ahead.
Question on the antenna topic that we were on about 10, 15 minutes ago.
Okay, Gene, that is a subject that we've already covered, and antennas are a subject you can never cover enough. So go ahead with your question on antennas, Gene, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm running high-band VHF, and I'm wondering, I'm running, I believe it's a quarter-wave whip antenna, about 18 inches in height. If I go for a taller antenna, is that going to give me more range per se, or is it just going to be ineffective?
I'm not sure I completely understand your question, Gene, but I'll tell you this. Particularly on VHF antennas, there's three things that make a VHF antenna work well, particularly in Jupiter, Florida. That's a little bit of a joke. And that is that the three things that make a VHF-UHF antenna work well are altitude, altitude, and altitude. You can make the yuckiest antenna in the world out of coat hanger wire on a UHF-VHF frequency. You hang it high enough in the air so that it clears your trees and clears the flower, the water towers, and clears the buildings and whatever, and you're going to be very happy with the performance. And then the next step beyond that is to increase the gain of the antenna by making it a vertically polarized Yagi or a phased array of antennas and whatever. But altitude first. You can take the most expensive antenna in the world with the highest gain in the world, and you mount it 3 feet above the ground on a VHF frequency where it's looking into the neighbor's house and looking into all the trees in your neighborhood and whatever, and most of the time you're going to be unhappy with the performance. Altitude first. Let me drop. When it comes to HF antennas, life gets a little bit more complicated. Mount an HF antenna real low, and it becomes a NEVIS antenna, near vertical incident sky wave. And the skip will be kind of short if that's what you desire. Mount it higher in the air, do whatever you've got to do to give it a low angle of radiation, and you start working some pretty good DX. So altitude is the main determining factor on an HF antenna that gives you the takeoff angle, that tells you what angle you're going to hit the ionosphere with, and it tells you something about the skip zone and what kind of range you're going to get out of it. So rarely does an antenna, though, behave poorly because you've mounted it too high up. If you've made the investment on almost any antenna to mount it higher, almost always you're going to be more happy. That's not the whole story, but maybe it helps, said Gene. KK4 Uniform Kilo Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Dick, I forgot to mention, I'm not trying to get a house, I'm not doing a house antenna mount at the moment. I'm working on an antenna for my car.
And make it a little bit more clear for me, Gene. The antenna you're putting on your car, is it an HF antenna or a VHF antenna? Back to you, Gene.
VHF, sir. I'm trying to... I currently have a quarter wave, about 18-inch VHF antenna on a mag mount for my car. But I'm trying to get more range out of it so I can repeat, so I can reach a little bit further out from the repeater.
Okay, on your automobile, you don't have very many choices. A 5/8 wave is going to give you a little more performance than a quarter wave, and it's worth fighting for, in my opinion. The taller piece of wire means you're going to be hitting the trees, and you're going to be hitting the garage door a little bit more frequently, but with a mag mount, that's not a big deal. But when it comes to real range from an automobile, I had 200 miles of range from my automobile on 2 meters, day in and day out. But there's a catch. Let me drop. And by the way, I was doing that with both a 5/8 wave, a wave mag mount vertically polarized, as well as a square loop antenna mag mount on the roof of the station wagon horizontally polarized. And I had a relay in the passenger compartment where I could flip back and forth between the two. And I was talking 200 miles, day in and day out, from my automobile, every time I was driving from Long Island up to Utica, New York. That's the good news. I was doing it on single sideband. I was running a Mirage amplifier that's rated for 160 watts, and with the 14 volts that comes out of my particular alternator of my Mercury station wagon at the time, I was getting 14 volts out of it. I was getting 180 watts of peak envelope power out of that brick amplifier. And on sideband, I was talking to a guy in southern New Jersey. I keep forgetting his call letters. Anyhow, he was running a good base station with 4 2-meter Yagis on 100 feet of power. So from southern New Jersey, with his 4 Yagis on 100 feet of power, talking to me on single sideband, because single sideband does so much better on range than FM. But as I drove from Long Island up to Utica, and it was 200 miles between us, we had 90% copy on single sideband over those 200 miles every day I did it, summer, winter, spring, and fall. So you can get an extra range. You're going to want to use sideband, and you're going to want to use some steam, and you want to talk to guys that are well-equipped. But when it comes to FM performance, let me drop. When it comes to FM performance from your automobile, transmitting-wise, you could run a couple of hundred watts. That'll help quite a bit when it comes to the uplink to the repeater. And the one thing that I've noticed is that most of the mobile rigs in the FM mode do not have a very good limiter. If you're driving by automobiles that have a lot of ignition static, it'll give the receiver quite a bit of grief. So you can easily, with 180 watts from the automobile, become what's more a alligator than a rabbit. In other words, you'll be stronger on transmit than receive. But if you're talking to good repeaters that are well located, I think a 70-mile range could be done with a good mobile installation. I have from time to time toyed with the idea of putting a rotatable Yagi on a station wagon automobile on 2 meters. But I knew that the problem would be I couldn't rotate it fast enough. If I was rotating it by Armstrong, in other words, if I had a speedometer cable, push-pull speedometer cable, with a lever arm in the passenger compartment, by which I could swing the Yagi real fast. Let me drop. And the reason I would want to swing the Yagi real fast is I wanted to make that Yagi be able to be parallel to my station wagon when I went through a toll booth. Because if the Yagi is sticking off to one side, I'd be stabbing the person in the eye that's taking my money at the toll booth. So it would be quasi-legal. So with a 2-meter Yagi that's rapidly rotatable by the Armstrong technique on a station wagon, that would be the next level of improvement on a station wagon automobile. But other than that, yes, you could put multiple ground planes on the automobile and steer them electronically as a phased array, and you'll pick up another 3 or 4 dB of gain. The Yagi could have picked me up 10 dB of gain with a 5-element Yagi on 2 meters, and on a station wagon, that was somewhat doable. I think that's about the limit of what you can do, from my opinion, Gene. KK4, Uniform Kilo Charlie, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for all 4 beeps.
Thank you, Dick. It was informative, pretty helpful. So I'll see what I can do. Thank you, sir. And KK4UKC, clear.
Okay, yep. And as you experiment with various installations on your automobile, if you happen to hit success on one of those, Gene, please come back and tell us about it. Don't keep that light under a bushel basket, if you know what I mean. Back to you, John, if you think we should go to another one. KC4WGB with the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, it's about it. It's 10:30. My guys are probably going off to sleep. But very good. Good mailbag and good net so far. So I'll throw it back to you and we'll go over to Paul with the space report. I didn't hear him check in, but I hope he's out there. KC2, WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Paul is always out there, and I heard him check in earlier. So, Paul, what is NASA doing? And just to keep me happy, give us a couple of words over and over again on what that Voyager is doing today. I think it's 12 billion miles away, 3 times the distance to Pluto, outside of the solar system, and that thing is still cranking, still moving something like 30,000 miles an hour. That's a piece of hardware. That's a QRP rig at the most miles per watt anybody's ever going to get. WS2N with the space report. K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Dick, also I have a question for Paul in the mailbag when he gets a chance.
Sounding good. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is WS2N space portion of the TechNet. And Voyager, well, of course, you've got two of them, both launched in 1977. And like you said in your preamble, Voyager 1 is into interstellar space, or they consider interstellar space, out of the solar system. Some people consider the Oort cloud the end of the solar system because of the gravitational effects. But NASA's idea is where the solar wind is deflected in a different direction. So they figured out that happened around August of last year. It took them a while to figure out from the evidence, lead detectors on Voyager, if that was true or not. And that's what they came up with. So since then, it's gone another 3 AU. It keeps moving out at roughly 40,000 miles per hour. And we drop it. And you've got two of them. One is at 103 AU, Voyage 2. And Voyage 1 is the one that's furthest out. And that's around 120, I think it's around 126 AU now. So it's a big time radio distance too. It just, I think yesterday or today, it just crossed the 35 hour round trip communication milestone. So transmit it, tell it to do something, and 35 hours later, you go to sleep. Next day, somewhere along lunchtime, if you did this in the middle of the night, the following 2 days later, you'll get a report from Voyager telling you, okay, it's been done, or I'm not going to deal with this other problem. Maybe my 8-track tape isn't working. That's what they use. To an old 8-track tape. It's just a tape that goes around and around, and that's what records all the digital information. It's transmitted back to Earth. So that's so much for that, Dick. Let me drop it.
Yeah, let me add a word on this one, Paul. Yeah, so far tonight, we've been discussing receiver selectivity measurements. And the receiver that's listening to Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 at Goldstone is one of the main receivers. And there's also, this is a 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, in the Mojave Desert at Fort Irwin. And I have visited that site. There's a similar dish in Honeysuckle Creek, Australia. And there's another one near Madrid, Spain. And so these things are all spaced roughly every 120 degrees in the longitude around the Earth. So as the Earth rotates, at least one of those dishes is capable of being measured, is capable of being aimed at Voyager. And to listen to Voyager, that 20-watt signal from that many billions of miles away, you better set that receiver at a very narrow selectivity. The selectivity they're using is in the vicinity of 150 hertz wide. So think about this. A 0.15 kilohertz bandwidth filter by way of a phase lock loop system, listening to a signal at 8,500 megahertz, 8.5 gigs, you take any normal receiver, you tune it at 8.5 gigs and try to get enough frequency accuracy so that your 150 hertz wide filter is in the right spot, so that it's in the center of that signal you want to listen to. Under normal circumstances, you try to do that, and it's tough. Let me drop. And here you have a piece of aging electronics launched in 1977, designed probably in 1970, and you're about to say, how in the world does the crystal on board have anywhere near enough frequency accuracy in all of those cosmic rays, and everything else is being bathed with in space, where the temperature is, the background temperature is around 3 degrees Kelvin. Cold is all hell. That's minus 270 degrees centigrade is the background temperature where that thing is sitting. It's not getting any solar heat, so to speak, except for the nuclear generator on board. There is no source of heat. It's in the coldest, darkest possible environment you and I can envision. How in the world can you design a receiver to not have enough frequency accuracy to the nearest 150 hertz? That's the bandwidth of what you're listening to. You'd like the frequency accuracy to be the nearest 10 hertz to make sure the signal is close to the center of that filter. How in the world do they do that? And the answer is they are not using crystal on board. The highest accuracy signal in the world that Voyager could use is the signal you sent to it. It's a transponder. You transmit up a signal telling Voyager, talk to me now, and I'm going to continuously give you a signal in the uplink so that you can transmit to me in the downlink. It uses the uplink signal as a frequency reference, and it sends back the signal at an exact ratio, 240 over 221. It takes the input frequency, divides it by 240, multiplies it by 221, and sends it back down. It's your own signal coming back down, therefore the frequency accuracy is perfect. There is no oscillator on board, so to speak, on Voyager. It uses the uplink signal as the reference. Very crafty.
Repeater, time out.
With that signal that weak, and that signal coming back down is probably something like minus 150 dBm. That's way beyond any normal dial and any normal signal generator. And that's the signal strength you get when you're using a 240-foot dish, which has probably got 65 dB of gain, listening to the signal. After 65 dB of gain, a 240-foot diameter dish, you're listening to a signal with amount around minus 150 dB. I can calculate it, but it's in that neighborhood. Super weak signal. And you got to use a 150 hertz bandwidth filter in order to make that signal above the noise so you can listen to the data. And how does it have enough accuracy? It's this transponder technique. This is a deep space network, an extremely crafty design. And so any normal crystal on board would be drifting by now, aging, drifting, doing all kinds of things, and you would never find that signal again because you know exactly where it's transmitting to you because it's using your signal. You know exactly where to look and where to find it. As I said, a very crafty system. WS2S, K2RIW. When it comes to measuring the selectivity of that system, as I see it, Paul, that one's out of sight in more ways than one. You got it, Paul. K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good. And, how many more years is it going to... I heard you talking about that earlier. Last I heard was 2025. So. And you don't have to worry about losing this signal. It'll only go about 35, 36 more AU. And it's that 125, 126 now. That's not much of a change. You know, even if they doubled it, then you would... You know, you'd have to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Probably start to fail. The generators on board, the plutonium RTG radioisotope thermoelectric generators will keep running for many decades to come. They think that probably the thermocouple action will probably fail. The heat that's given off is hitting these graphite blankets. Keeps it all trapped inside this one area. And that's where you get your heat. Thermocouples, countless amount of those are hooked up in series and parallel to generate your power. They still use their batteries on board to keep everything running. They expect to talk to Voyager for another at least 10 more years, maybe more, 10, 12 more years. So, pretty good. And, both Voyagers are still functioning. A couple other things I want to mention, Dick, unless you want to talk more about Voyagers, is WS2N.
Nope. I like talking about Voyager a little bit each time. It's just something that still enthralls me, as you can tell, Paul. I'm satisfied with Voyager. Go on to the real subject. You got a poll.
Big comment, Dick?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Paul, Sean, go right ahead, John.
Well, Dick, being that we're both about the same age, if you remember the post-war era, it's 46, 47, my family would place calls to Europe, Italy and Germany, check on family and stuff. And you called, we didn't have dial, you called an operator who got you in. Long-distance operator who put you in contact with an overseas operator, gave the information, and they called you back, if you were lucky, maybe in an hour. And that's a 6,000-mile round trip. Look at what we're doing with Voyager. Amazing. People are too complacent about what's going on. It's fantastic. Just thought I'd drop that in there. Back to you, Dick.
Sure is, John. Go ahead, Paul. I'll wait for the beeps.
And I look forward to New Horizon joining that group. And that's also got an RTG on board, so that should be fun. Another 10, 20 years from now, we'll be talking about that thing leaving the solar system as well. Just wanted to mention we have one launch coming up. It was supposed to be November 1st, but it looks like it's changed to the 12th. SpaceX is putting up a spacecraft built by SES, European country, that's going to put a geosynchronous communication satellite above the Asia and Indonesia, and they want to increase the capability that they have over there, so they hired SpaceX to use their Falcon 9 rocket, and he's got the more advanced Falcon 9 rocket that's going to be launched from Florida, version 1.1, they call it. It's a bigger rocket than what they used to supply the International Space Station with, the Dragon spacecraft that they built. SpaceX has this advanced Falcon 9 rocket that they launched one other time before, about a month ago, a little less than that, from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and it was successful. It's about 60% longer than the original Falcon 9 rocket. It still has the 9 rockets on the first stage, single rocket for the second stage. And it's been delayed from the 1st of November to the 12th because when they did launch from Vandenberg, they planned on relaunching the second stage.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let me see if I have it here. Don't think I left enough time there. But their second stage did ignite, but then it shut itself off. It didn't like something that it saw in the vacuum. Where it was, apparently they think that some kind of different readings were detected, and they're going to go through this with a fine-tooth comb. They need the second stage to reignite, because this is a geosynchronous mission, so, I mean, this is a practical purpose for it. I mean, last time it was just practice to see how they're going to do on bringing these stages back to Earth for reusability, but this time with the geosynchronous flight, they have to reignite it not only once but twice to get it to its proper location, and then without any kind of a problem, they'll put that at the 23,000 mile height that's required. So that's why they're going to have a delay. Now this spacecraft that's being put up is built by Orbital Science. That's the same company that's also in competition with SpaceX to bring cargo to the International Space Station. In fact, they have a spacecraft attached to it now called Cygnus that went up about a month or so ago from Wallops Island, Virginia. So here you have two companies in a space race, but yet working together, which I like to see. And many other companies are also in this,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Bring them to the space station a couple of few years from now, maybe 3-4 years from now. So, the other space races going on between other countries as well. For instance, you have, China trying to send a spacecraft to China to Mars from China, and what's happened there was that was a failure a couple of years back. India sent stepped up to the plate, and they plan on launching a rocket from India to Mars, actually next month. And that's kind of a interesting project, because when it gets to Mars, it'll be arriving one day different than a spacecraft that we have that's going to be launched next month. The MAVEN spacecraft will be going up on November 18th, and that's the NASA-built spacecraft that will be arriving just one day different, September 22nd of next year. And kind of similar types of missions. MAVEN's going to be studying the upper atmosphere. It's got eight different instruments on board. And India, I think it's less sophisticated stuff on board, but still they're going to be going into our orbit day apart. I mean, they're not going to be close to one another. In fact, India is going more as an equatorial orbit, roughly about 17 degrees inclination, where MAVEN's going to be at 75 degree inclination. And both highly elliptical. They'll be going down low near the upper atmosphere, taking readings, and then coming further out. For instance, MAVEN will have a 4.5 hour orbit to go around Mars, which is going to make it a little problematic to use it as a relay system to help out Odyssey, which is one of the communication satellites that are up there, and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, also by NASA. That's their main.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Of course, Curiosity. So that's the latest on that. You've got India fighting off China, and we're competing against India and all these other countries that want to really step up to the plate and have a actually future manned missions. China has a small space station up there now. Plan on having another one, probably 2015, and then one after that, probably 2020, large one that'll probably be multiple sections put together. And of course, they have goals of sending people to the moon. So that's what we're doing lately in space, not only NASA, but worldwide. There's a lot more to it, but that's about all we can cover. Any questions, you can always email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com, and we'll turn it over to Dick. And I know John had a space question. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS.
Very fine, Paul. I'm going to go over to John for his space question, and then if anyone else has any further questions about space, any of the vehicles that NASA has launched, or any of these other competing commercial organizations that are launching vehicles, or other countries that are launching vehicles, seems like Paul has a significant familiarity with all of them. So form your questions while I pass it over to John, and then we'll go over to those questions after John. KC2WGB with a space question. K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, sorry about this, Dick. This is a question that came in the mailbag. Actually, it came through the chat room. It's a question about Voyager. I should have presented it earlier, but pardon the delay. Let me drop them. I'll ask the question. And well, if Paul knows, is there any reason for a sequel to Voyager? Do you think they'll be doing it again with all of the betterments we have now compared to 1970, which I believe was the design date you said, Dick, somewhere around there? Do you think they will revisit that program and try again? Is there any more information that they could glean, or do you think they're satisfied with what they have now? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Voyager was a 1977 launched, I guess you could call it a 1976 design, and here we are, what, 40, let me think, it's
think it was a, if it was 80, that would be 37 years ago. 37 years ago, hardware. That traveling wave tube is still cranking. That nuclear generator, which generates heat, which by way of the thermocouples converts it to electrical energy. I think the thing had something in the vicinity of a couple of kilowatts of electrical power in the beginning, which I know they've been turning off various things and because the power has been slowly dropping. And they're way beyond the original design lifetime. I bet you the original design was a few years, and here we are 37 years downrange. The New Horizon, which is on the way toward Pluto, I'm guessing Paul's going to tell us, has a lot better instrumentation on board. It's not going to stop at Pluto and go into orbit. It's going to fly by Pluto and keep right on going. So I think that's the closest thing we have to a replacement for Voyager. That's my guess. Let's see what Paul has got to say about this. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N. Yeah, I remember when that whole setup was put together. They called it the Grand, was it the Grand Tour? And that alignment of all those planets, Jupiter, Saturn, then on to Uranus and Neptune, was set up perfectly. I think it was 230 years later they would have that similar alignment. You'll never see that ever again. You know, you might see somebody decide to put a spacecraft directly to Uranus or something like that, but you have this fantastic setup that you couldn't have asked for anything better, and they needed to go that year to do it. A flyby of Jupiter with a gravitational assist, a flyby of Saturn with the same gravitational assist, and the same for Uranus and Neptune. So that was great. And then Pluto, of course, was out of alignment at that time, and they said, let's put something together. And they talked about it for years right after that launch, and they came up with something called the Pluto Express. Drop it. It was originally planned on a 12-year mission, 12, 13-year mission. It was going to have gravity assist from Earth and so on, you know, and would have gone around, you know, one big orbit, similar to what Juno is doing now on the way to Jupiter. And funding was cut and problems. Eventually, they came up with New Horizons. And that they put on a Atlas V, the five big solids attached to it, most powerful rocket at the time, and created a direct shot to Pluto. And in 10 years, that I mean, instead of 12 or 13 or 15 years like they were thinking originally, the thing was heading to. Pluto 10 years, which was very, very good. I was surprised they got the funding for it. Things were tight and everything went. So that will be going into the Kuiper Belt afterwards. And like you said, Dick, eventually that will go into planetary. There's nothing on the books right now to go to any of the other gas planets. Right now, that's it. There are no replacements. And that's it. I mean, we did this before. Let me drop it. They actually started out with the Pioneer spacecraft. They flew past Jupiter. And they are also leaving the solar system, but no longer functioning. They don't have that capability. We've lost contact with Pioneer 10 and 11. So Voyagers were actually replacements for that. We don't have anything that I know or that they've been talking about. I think that answers the question, John. Back to that WS tonight.
like Ed is on his constitutional tonight, kind of late. And so, what's new with you, Ed? And give us a comment. Grumman, you're working for what used to be called Grumman, Northrop Grumman, and they did a beautiful job of designing that lunar module, as well as the EA-6 and the P-3C, P-3D. And so, give us your comment about space probes, Ed. Mr. EAV, K2RAW in the TechNet.
There is a fascinating footnote to the New Horizons Pluto craft. Pluto is credited to the discovery with one Clyde Tombaugh, who passed away about 15 years ago. He was cremated. Half of his ashes are on that journey, which gives a whole new meaning, a whole new paradigm to manned spaceflight. Back to Dick.
The trip does it, and symbolic, yes. Significant, it depends on your point of view. But in the case of Voyager, taking this grand tour, where it passed by Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, as it passed by each one of those planets, it had just the right position of the planet, just the right trajectory of the spacecraft, that it got a gravity assist, a slingshot effect assist, as it went by each one of those. And by the way you fly past a planet, whether you fly past it on the sun side of the planet or the non-sun side, you can use the gravity assist of the planet to either speed up or slow down. It turns out that when you launch any spacecraft into space, let me drop.
Change the trajectory, Dick, as well.
Yeah, change the trajectory, sure. You have no choice but to do that. You didn't do it because you wanted to change trajectory per se. In the case of getting the gravity assist, the gravity assist slingshot effect is going to give you some extra velocity, is the good news. You have to sacrifice the fact that you're going to aim in a different direction after that gravity assist. And you think you're launching a spacecraft between Earth and Jupiter, Earth and Mars, Earth and Saturn, whatever. Not really. As soon as that spacecraft leaves Earth's nearby gravity, that spacecraft is flying in the solar system. Your trajectory is purely determined by the gravity of the sun until you come near some other planet. You're really in orbit around the sun when you leave the Earth. And that's what determines how far you go before you fall back down, so to speak, or how much...
Repeater, time out.
Or how much your path gets changed. Make a guess, Paul. That grand tour of Voyager, flying by four planets and getting a gravity assist from each, if those planets were not properly aligned, if we were not using the slingshot approach, using the rocket power you had in 1977, I'm guessing you wouldn't have more than one-third of your current range of Voyager. And I think by now it would have reached the apogee of orbit and fallen and be falling back down toward the sun. What's your guess as to what kind of range and velocity we would have had if we didn't get four gravity assists in that grand tour? Has anyone estimated how much of a cutback in performance that would have been without those four gravity assists? WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Well, you would have had a situation like Juno. I mean, Juno is the heaviest spacecraft, but same idea applies. It went out to about the asteroid belt. I mean, a direct shot from Earth. All power they had, and eventually started to fall back, like you said, toward the sun. Essentially, went into orbit around the Earth. So, even so, the Earth took a year to go make one revolution. It took 2.5 years to eventually catch up to the second orbit of Earth by the time it came around the sun and used the Earth as a gravitational assist. I mean, with all the power we had, and that was only 2.5 years ago, to put Juno up there, that's about as far as we got out to the asteroid belt. The reason New Horizon is able to make it all the way to Pluto is that they made it a light spacecraft. I mean, it doesn't have retros on there or anything to slow it down. It would have been a very heavy spacecraft. When they give the weights of the spacecraft, you know, this thing is going out, it's 2,000 pounds or whatever it is, for a small spacecraft, let's say. Half of that is usually weight, fuel. Like the Juno is roughly a 8,000-pound craft that they launched, but half of that is, it winds up being fuel to slow it down. Voyager didn't have that problem. It didn't have retros on it, but a relatively heavy spacecraft. Didn't have to worry about it because it was going to get their gravitational assist. When I said change trajectory, you know, you've got one actually going to the northern end of the ecliptic and Voyager 2 going to the southern end of the ecliptic. Because of the what they did toward the end, Voyager 1 with trying to get close to Titan, they used the gravitational assist of Saturn to actually change that direction pretty extensively, so that when it came around the other side, it was able to pick up Titan and get a close view of that. But by, you know, after that, there was no way to change it. Trajectory or anything, so it just kept going. And the same thing with Voyager 2. I think they need Triton, the moon around Neptune was important to that. And they kind of changed the trajectory of that as well. So that's heading north for, I don't know, 28 degrees or something to the south. So it's an interesting question, but you know, these things would have never made it to where they are. And that's why New Horizon, let me drop it, not surpass Voyager. The pioneers didn't have the, didn't go out to the other two planets. Voyager eventually caught up and passed pioneers. Pioneers were launched before Voyager. New Horizon does not have the gravity assist, and because of that, it will be traveling, by the time it gets out to the Kuiper Belt, 8,000 miles per hour slower than what the Voyagers are doing now. Voyagers are roughly around a little over 40,000 miles per hour. So, New Horizon will never surpass Voyager. 20, 30 years, 100 years from now, Voyager still will have the claim of being the furthest spacecraft launched by mankind. Back to you, Dick.
I just added a simplification that may help a little bit. Assume that every one of the planets is in the so-called ecliptic plane, and they're very close to doing that. So they're all going around the sun in roughly the same plane as the Earth. And in a simplified diagram, make believe that every one of them has a orbit, has a axis of rotation that's perpendicular to that plane. In other words, every one of them has North Pole straight up, so to speak. And now you carefully fly your spacecraft past Mars, and you decide to fly it over the North Pole of Mars. As it flies over the North Pole and gets deflected by that gravity, you could say it's going to go over the North Pole and then start going down the far side of Mars, being bent by the gravity of field of Mars, and now it's going to be curving in its path and end up going south through the plane of the ecliptic. So as it flies over the North Pole, it's going to be bent to the south. Or you could decide to fly it under the South Pole, and as it passes by the planet, it's going to be bent to the north. And flying it over the pole, I believe, is not going to give you anywhere near as much gravity assist as if you recognize that every one of these planets is going around the sun counterclockwise top view.
If you go up above the ecliptic plane to the north and look down, every one of the planets goes around the sun in a counterclockwise direction. So if you decide to launch your spacecraft on what to you looks like the eastern side of the planet, it's going to go past the eastern side of the planet, get curved around to the back side of the planet to the left, and pick up velocity. If you decide to fly it toward the west side of the planet, the left side, it would be curved around to the right and decrease in velocity. So depending on which side of the planet you decide to aim your spacecraft and fly it past the planet, you could end up being deflected to the south, deflected to the north, slowed down, or speed up. And the process of speeding it up is not so clear what's going on. Let me give you a simple explanation as to what I think is going on there. Let me drop. And it's a little bit like that ball on the end of a string, and you hold the string above your head, and you move your hand in a characteristic manner so the ball swings in a circle above your head on the end of that string. And if you realize what you're doing, you're moving your hand in a very characteristic manner by about an inch or so in synchronization with the swinging of the ball. The ball might be on the end of a string where the string is 3 feet long, and the ball eventually is moving, you know, 30 miles an hour, 40 miles an hour in a circle around the top of your head, and your fingers, your hand is holding onto the string, and your hand is moving about an inch, but the movement of your hand is in synchronism, and at each swing of your hand, each orbit of that ball and string picks up a little bit of energy. It takes very little energy of your hand, very little motion of your hand, but you're doing it in synchronized manner. Therefore, each swing is adding energy. Very similar to pushing your child on a swing. Each push is giving a little bit more energy to that system, and she's swinging a little bit further. So the planet is by comparison to the velocity of the spacecraft, the planet is moving kind of slowly. But it's in synchronization when you fly it across the eastern side of the planet, and you end up being deflected to the left, but you end up with a higher velocity after you've done it. Some of the planet's velocity gets added to your velocity as you fly by. It ain't clear. But when it comes to, let me drop. Each one of these spacecraft that we launch is really in orbit around the sun. So when you want to put something in orbit around Mercury, you're starting off at the third planet called Earth. You're starting off with a hell of a lot more potential energy because we are a lot further away from the sun. And you want to go down there toward Mercury, much closer to the sun. It's a much lower energy orbit. You've got to do flybys in such a way that you lose energy and slow down as you go down toward Mercury, if you intend to go in orbit around Mercury. So you've got to be using these gravity assists in reverse direction in order to lose energy, because you're really in solar orbit as you launch that spacecraft. A lot of people don't realize that. You think it's just a straight path between you and the planet you're aiming at. 99% of that path, after you've left the near vicinity of Earth, you're now in solar orbit, and that determines what your trajectory is going to look like until you start flying by some other planet. I wonder if anybody's ever explained it with any of the articles you've seen quite that way, Paul. And these are a bunch of speculations on my part. There could be some error here. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Unfortunately, what we don't have is, well, we could probably have it on the net. Everybody has a computer, but diagrams are very helpful. Some of the diagrams that you bring up, you go to NASA, and they'll show you the orbits of Juno or all the different spacecraft that use gravity assist and how they slow down. You talk about Mercury, you know, Messenger spacecraft, how they did it. They used Venus to slow down, and eventually you got pulled into the orbit of Mercury the first time we did that. Difficult task. You've that Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, I want to go back to that because you did change the trajectory drastically on Voyager 2. They wanted so much to look at.